some interest on your side. There is definitely overlap between Bianca's interest and mine. And then please ask questions, interrupt me, whatever. Okay, so I will tell you about a lot of work, and most of it has been done in collaboration with Glenn Evenly at UC Irvine at the moment. And I'll start with a disclaimer, okay? So this workshop has a title, Renormalization in Background Independent Theories, Foundations and Techniques, and I'm glad that my talk is about renormalization. But this talk is not about background independent theories, okay? So we'll leave that part on the side for the experts, and I'll just talk about renormalization, foundations, and techniques. Very good. And the main goal of this whole research program is to define a proper RC transformation on the lattice, okay? And so proper, what do I mean by proper? We're still trying to figure it out. But one thing that we will require for sure is consistency with what we know in the continuum. So what you want to think about is we have a field theory, we have a scale transformation defined for a field theory, okay? So we want to work on the lattice, and we would like to define some scale or RG transformation on the lattice. I'm going to talk about the scale transformation or RG transformation as if they were the same. And so basically what we want to do is we want to explore what do we need to do on the lattice so that these diagrams commute. And my pointer is gone. Okay. So do we have, here. So to reiterate a little bit, if we have a discretization transformation that takes a field theory into a lattice model, and this could be as brute as, you know, you take your field theory, you replace a derivative with finite differences and so on. If we have such a procedure, then and we know how in the continuum a theory would behave, then we would like to have a cosine transformation that matches these expectations. Okay, on the lattice, we would like that these two things commute, that if we make a scale transformation on the field theory and then we discretize, we get the same as if we had first discretized and then made the cosine transformation on the lattice. All right? And what does this mean? Well, in particular, it means many things. But in particular, what we would like is that if in the continuum we have a fixed point of the RG flow, if in the continuum we are studying a CFT, for instance, when we put it on the lattice, we would like that on the lattice, this lattice version of the CFT, or this critical lattice system, also behaves, also becomes a fixed point of our cosine transformation. So that's a requirement. We'll go back to it all the time. So there have been many strategies aiming at defining a renormalization transformation, an RG transformation on the lattice, and our strategy will have the following. It will be characterized by paying special attention to removing short-range entanglement or correlations from the lattice that we're cosigning. Good. So I've divided this talk in three parts. The first part is going to be about wave functions. We will be interested in a quantum system, say a spin chain, quantum spin chain. We'll be talking about how to cosgrain the Hilbert space of the spin chain in a way that we preserve the low energy subspace of the Hamiltonian. And the result will be that we'll obtain some ansatz called meta or multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, which appears to be a good description of ground states. The second part will be about, again, quantum systems in 1+1 dimensions, but this time we'll take the Euclidean path integral, okay? And we'll first represent it as a tensor network. In this case, this tensor network is an exact representation of the Euclidean path integral. It's not an ansatz. And what we'll study is ways to take this Euclidean path integral or this 2D statistical partition function and cosgrain it again according to some rules, with the requirement that this cosgrain transformation be compatible with what we expect in the continuum. So in particular, if this was the partition function of a classical, the 2D classical Ising model at criticality, we would like this transformation to explicitly reveal scale invariance in the sense that there will be tensors attached to this first description, microscopic description. When we cosgrain, we would like this effective tensor A prime to be equal to A. Okay? So that would be the second part. And the third part, I've added some material in case there is time, but I'm not going to rush it. And so in the third part, what we would see is that actually these two approaches are closely related, and this one produces the multiscale and time and renormalization answers as a result. And if there is time also, I will look into ways of not just performing global scale transformations on the lattice, or this RC transformation, but actually also local scale transformations, so that we won't just see scale invariants, we'll see conformal invariants on the lattice, or at least traces of conformal invariants on the lattice. Very good. And in this talk, I want to focus on the ideas and on but I thought I would start by just displaying some results so that you have you can gauge you can decide whether you want to take this approach seriously or not. So what can Mera or this tensor network renormalization do for you? So as an input, what we need is a one-dimensional quantum system or quantum Hamiltonian or two-dimensional classical Hamiltonian on the lattice, and already tuned so that it's at the critical point. Okay, so let me take that as an input. You give me the criticalizing model, for instance. As an output, what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to numerically extract the conformal data of the underlying continuous theory, on the underlying conformal field theory. In particular, we'll be able to compute the central charge, the scaling dimensions and conformal spins of at least the low-lying spectrum of scaling dimensions and conformal spins of all scaling operators, and the operator product expansion coefficients for that rule what happens when you fuse such, when you look at the fusion of such scaling fields. So as an example, and this is from 2008, if we start with the criticalizing model, this would be actually the 1D transverse spilizing model. Then what we can do with a very reasonable amount of computation, say about an hour on your laptop, no big machines involved, we can obtain the spectrum, as I was saying. Say I'm focusing here on the scaling dimensions. So what we see is that this theory from the lattice, we never take a continuum limit, and that's something that we may want to discuss later. What we observe is that there are scaling operators with scaling dimension 0, 1 over 8, 1, and then they're on descendant, and so that's indeed the identity, the spin, the energy density, primary fields of the CFT. We also get the disorder operator and the fermion operators. And the numerical estimates are quite accurate for, say, the scaling dimension. So this should be 0.125, and you see that we get a few digits correctly. This should be 1. This should be, again, 1/8 or 1. So these two should be a 0 in practice, and this should be 1/2 and 1/2 and so on. Okay, so this is high precision data, conformal data, on properties that are not a local operator. It's not the energy. It's not the expectation value of the energy, but actually this determines the asymptotic decay of correlations at large distances. So all this is done directly in the thermodynamic limit. There are no finite size effects. And then once we have the scaling operators, or we end up with a lattice representation of the scaling operators of the theory, then we can also compute the operator product expansion coefficients, and we get the exact results, or the results obtained from in the continuum from the CFT with three digits of precision as well. Okay, so the idea is that the structures that the construction that I'm going to describe seems to work quite well at describing, say, on the lattice, the equivalent of a CFT. Okay. Good. So let me go into part one. So what's the motivation here? What we're trying to do is, in this first part, is we want to efficiently describe many-body wave functions on the lattice. And so if you have, as you know, if you have a system of n quantum spins, spin 1/2 quantum degrees of freedom, then you can write the wave function for the n spins using a number of complex parameters that scales as exponentially in n. It's 2 to the n complex parameters that it will take to specify this wave function. Okay. Now what we're going to do is we're going to use a tensor network. And diagrammatically, I'm going to write this equal to that. And let me spend a minute, though I suspect some of you are already familiar with this notation, let me spend a minute explaining what it means. So in this talk, if you see a circle that stands for a complex number, if you see a circle with a leg, that's a vector, okay? So that's an array of complex numbers labeled by an index, that's the leg. If you see a circle with two legs, that's a matrix, okay? A tensor with two indices, and so on. If you see a circle with n legs, that is representing a tensor with n indices, okay? And so this is half of what I have to say. The other half is as follows. If you see two circles with a line connecting them, that means that these are two tensors where they share an index, implying that there is a contraction over that index. There is a sum. So for instance, this thing here looks like a matrix because it has two indices, two legs. This one looks like a matrix, it has two legs. And if you look at this, this is one matrix multiplied by another matrix, right? Because there is a sum, or there is a shared index, therefore a sum, and the result is indeed a matrix, okay? So we have this thing here. This thing here, if you look at, as a second example, if you look at this tensor network, this is a small tensor network, there are no open indices, okay? Therefore, this is a number, which is the result of multiplying a vector times a matrix times a vector. Okay, is that clear? It should be clear, but I'm just checking with you. Okay, so that indeed is a number. Okay, so no, very good, very good. So you are very used to this, but I'm going to one thing should be clear. I'm not going to. This is not a spin network. So in particular. Okay, very good. So I'm not going to assume. Perfect. So there are no symmetries here, okay? So when I say a tensor, I just mean an array of complex numbers indexed by some number of indices.
So if you have no symmetry, how do you know from a tensor which is the first index?
You don't.
Okay.
You should be supplemented with additional information, okay?
I have a question. Where in that notation is the complex conjugate? My dagger?
You'll have to specify it. So it's not a complete notation. It's just telling you have all these tensors, how the indices are contacted with each other, as in spin networks. But forget about thinking about representation of SU2. You could add that. But one of the points of this talk is that I'm going to take it very simple. At most, I'll consider a Z2 symmetry for the Ising model. Okay, and we'll see where what we want to deal is with the complexity of this problem, ignoring constraints, ignoring symmetries, anything. Just assuming that we have a many-body state. Okay.
Where is your index space? Is it one
dimensional? The index space. Each index takes a number of integer values, from 1 to chi, and chi will be some refinement parameter that will change. Okay.
Chi-dimensional.
Right. So if you see that in the case of a matrix, that would be a chi times chi matrix. Yes. Okay, perfect. So that will be a trace of four matrices and so on. And why bother? Well, you are used to this notation. So the idea is that if you have to multiply these guys together, the first thing that you'll try to do is to understand the connectivity between the different tensors. Okay, so we can go back to here. But I really want you to make an effort to not see this as a spin network. Okay. So what we're saying here is that we're going to consider a subclass of a state. Not every wave function can be written in this way. We're going to consider a subclass of wave functions that can be written as the product of tensors, of a small tensors. And when I say small, is in the following sense. First, here we see that we require 2 to the n parameters to specify the wave function. So that's an inefficient description. Here instead, what we're going to assume, as Laurent was asking, is that these bond indices, the indices connecting the tensors, have finite bond dimension. We call it bond dimension, chi, okay? Say 100, 1,000, just some number. That's right. The open indices, there is no choice in the open indices. They represent they go into the vector space, the local vector space, say the spin, the vector space of a spin 1/2 degree of freedom. So in this case, that would be two values. It could be five values. It really depends on the system you are analyzing, right? So there is no choice on the open indices, but on the bond indices, you can decide how many values they are going to take. And if we fix that to be, say, chi, so by fixing it, I mean, if we make it independent of n, of the number of spins that we're describing, then what we have is indeed that, well, each tensor will take some number of parameters, chi squared times 2. And the total number of parameters is going to be proportional to the number of tensors that we're putting here, n, okay? And so we have it. You can put different tensors, but I'm assuming that the bond dimension is the same. Bond dimension chi, the number of values an index takes. I'm going to assume that it's homogeneous through the.
Okay, but you vary like from node to node.
The tensors can change from node to node. That's right. Okay, so once we do that, then what's the point of all this? If we wanted to add one spin on this side, we would add an index that would mean 2 to the n plus 1. So we will double the number of complex parameters. In here instead, if we want to add one spin, we just add one tensor, right? So the parameters will be order n plus 1. It's not growing exponentially, okay? It's just growing linearly. Okay, so that's the stress that I want to make. This is not about representations of SE2. This is about how the number of parameters scale with the system size. Right, so what's happening? Well, this definitely cannot be equal in general. There are exponentially many parameters. There are only linearly many here. So what we're doing is we're considering a variational class defined by the tensor network. We have a huge Hilbert space of all possible states of n spins. And we're just going to focus on some small subregion, right? And how large this subregion is depends on the bond dimension. As you consider a larger bond dimension, you consider a slightly larger region. Yes?
I'm sorry, I really don't understand how this transformation reduces your number of parameters, because you still have the three indices on the second side.
That's right.
So wouldn't you have ON plus 2N three parameters? I mean, how come on the tensor network side, the
yes.
number of free indices at the bottom is not your parameters anymore?
The definition is many body wave functions. So these indices are all contracted with the basis state, which is fixed.
I do not understand your question. Can you repeat it?
So the I's are not free parameters. They are just, they are indices which you sum over.
And the dots, which are the matrices, are the three parameters. Mm. So here what you have is a collection of tensors. Each tensor has three indices, and it takes chi squared times two complex parameters to specify one tensor. Right? And then if you want to obtain the whole wave function, you would have the exponentially many coefficients, you will have to multiply these tensors together. I did not understand the question, sorry.
Okay.
Okay, maybe you're right about the number of different indices, but they're not all independent. On the left-hand side, they're all independent, so you have to choose all of them. On the right-hand side, you only have to specify these little dots.
That's right.
So you only have to specify the matrix entries of each of these dots. And that's just gives you the whole thing in terms of just a few parameters.
Okay. Maybe we can discuss this later. Okay, so what's happening then is that we're just addressing a subregion of the whole Hilbert space. We're not going to be able to represent all possible wave functions, but our hope is that there is a similar picture that has been developed over the last 10 years, which says that in the huge Hilbert space, there are many states, but actually we are interested in ground states of local Hamiltonians and small excitations over a ground state. And it turns out that if we want to study those ground states of local Hamiltonians are very special. They do not behave as a generic state in the full Hilbert space. In particular, if you look at the entanglement entropy, there is this area law of entanglement entropy that for a generic state would so for a ground state we observe this area law, and a generic state instead obeys this volume law. So what this is telling us is that ground states are extremely special. They also belong, ground states of arbitrary local Hamiltonians, they all have in common a number of things, including the way entanglement scales. And this means that they also form a small region in this Hilbert space. And our hope, and I'll leave it at that, at hope, is that this manifold here of variational states that we can represent as a tensor network has some non-trivial overlap with the ground states that we're interested in studying.
Sorry, I thought there was a statement about the generic state in Hilbert space. Is the way it's as close as you want to maximally entangled states.
That's right.
So how does that fit with that thing? It seems to say that
the maximally entangled state, if you pick up random a state with, if you choose 2 to the n coefficient randomly, complex coefficients, and you write the wave function, and now you look at how entangled this state is, it's maximal entangled state, and that reflected with a volume law for entanglement entropy. The entanglement of a region is proportional to the size of the region. Okay, so that's consistent with what you knew, right? And what I'm saying is that ground states have seemed to not obey this law. So ground states are not generic states in the Hilbert space at all. They are much, much less entangled. Okay? So this tells you there is hope. There is hope that we have identified the property of ground states. We wanted to represent efficiently ground states, right? And we have identified a property that tells us that they are not generic states. So we cannot represent a generic state in here, but maybe we can represent efficiently a generic state, a generic ground state of a local Hamiltonian.
Okay, so they are quasi local. The local state in the PTA is not that.
That's right. So they are very close to non-entangled.
So they are
yes.
They are entangled in a special.
That's the main conclusion that we've drawn over the last 10 years or so about, from studying ground states or the entanglement in ground states. They
is
are
there,
not
is
very
there
entangled.
A precise measure to what extent, if you scale the dimension of the input space, what proportion of states, satisfies area overflow versus volume
flow? The proportion is zero.
Zero, but let's say, as a codimension, you can have a measure zero object.
So the codimension has to be something, right? So here's the dimension here is exponentially large, and these guys should have order n dimension. So the codimension should be exponential.
Yeah.
Right. Okay? Very good. Yes?
You always choose a line for your tensor network? Or
no, I will not. I was just giving you an example.
Okay.
I will, right.
When you say local Hamiltonian, you mean there will be a difference between ferro or anti-ferro.
Right, no. That's the point, that you have a local, by local Hamiltonian, I mean, on a lattice, I mean a Hamiltonian made of a sum of terms which couple nearest neighbors, or maybe also next to nearest neighbors, or farther away, but where the strength of the interactions are exponentially suppressed, for instance, in the distance between the sides. That's what a local Hamiltonian is for me. And the point is that it doesn't matter what physics you are describing.
Doesn't matter if there's a mass gap or not?
No. I mean, the mass, if it's massless in 1+1 dimensions, they'll give you a logarithmic correction to this area law. But this is right. And in 2 dimensions, if you have a Fermi surface, again, you'll have a logarithmic correction to this area law. But from area law to volume law, the logarithmic correction is nothing.
And if you can take an arbitrary tree instead of a line, do you still cover the same zone in the Hilbert space, or do you explore?
Essentially. I mean, okay, so different tensor networks will cover slightly different zones, but if you put all together all the tensor networks you can think of, which are efficient, an efficient description, they'll be still of zero measure in the full Hilbert space.
Is there any example of ground states of local Hamiltonian that is beyond tensor network representation?
You can engineer such examples. It's not clear that they are of any relevance from a physical perspective, but you can try and engineer some. Yes. And they may involve many different energy scales, and you really have to design it carefully. But you can do it. Okay, so tensor networks just. Let me tell you that it's the effort of many people, and they are not all listed here, and that we started with computational condensed matter. We were trying really to develop an ansatz to efficiently represent wave functions so that we could study interacting spins or fermions or whatever. But it got a bit out of control, and then it, some authors started using it as an analytical framework to, say, analyze the classify possible gap phases of quantum matter. So that was, in this work, for instance, it was not used as a numerical or as a variational ansatz, but already as the right language to describe the ground states of, in this case, gap systems. It's being used in material science, in quantum chemistry, in classical statistical mechanics. We'll see a bit of that today. And we'll see a lot of application to the renormalization group. The holographers are taking some serious interest into one of these tensor networks. And then I hear the quantum gravity people also. Bianca has been using tensor networks and encouraging the use of tensor networks for a while. Very good. So today I'm not going to talk about generic tensor networks. I'm going to focus on one, this one. This one goes by the name of multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And so this is going to be an ansatz to describe the ground state of a Hamiltonian in 1D. So think of a spin chain, a quantum spin chain. This is meant to be a tensor network to efficiently describe the ground state of such a quantum spin chain. And so the first thing you see is that it's a variational class of states for one-dimensional systems. The open indices here are in one are arranged as a one-dimensional array. There is periodic boundary conditions, so this index connects with this one and so on, right? And what you can see is that even though we are trying to represent states in 1D, the tensor network itself extends in an extra dimension, okay? This is in contrast with the previous example that we had. Okay, so what is the point of having this extra dimension? Well, the first thing is that variational parameters for different length scales are stored in different tensors. What I'm saying here is that this tensor here, which is very close to the boundary where we have the one-dimensional spin chain, this tensor, if we change its variational parameters, this will only induce a local change in the wave function, okay? So if you had all the spins pointing up plus fluctuations and you want to change the spin in the middle to so that it essentially points down, you go here and you change some variational parameters in this tensor. Whereas if you want to change global properties of the wave function, you go higher up. For instance, this tensor here, if we change the variational parameters, it will affect the wave function in all this range down here. Or this tensor will affect the whole wave function. So we have the ability to store in different places of the network variational parameters which address different length scales in the system. And this tensor network, to understand why what it's doing or what it means, it's worth pointing out that it's secretly both a quantum circuit and a renormalization group transformation. This was built as a renormalization group transformation. So let me spend a few minutes explaining these two points. So let's first have a look at this as a quantum circuit. Okay. So again, in the end, this is just a bunch of tensors. If you multiply, if you make all the contractions, you get this huge exponentially large tensor with exponentially many coefficients for a wave function. But let's not multiply them together. Let's keep it like this so that we don't have a computational problem. And the first observation is that there are two types of tensors. Some tensors have four legs, and I'm going to call them disentanglers. They can be thought of as a unitary gate acting on two qubits or two spins. That's just a unitary transformation on two spins. So these are input spins and output spins or qubits. Then there is a second type of tensor here with one, two, and three legs. I'm going to call them isometries. Okay, and you can imagine that this is as some gate where you input one spin and you get two spins out. But actually, we're going to think of this as the result of having, again, a two-body unitary gate, a two-spin gate, where one of the inputs is fixed, right? So the same way that if you have a matrix and you fix one of the indices, you get a vector. If you have a tensor with four legs, if you fix one of the indices, of course, you get a tensor with three legs. So we can think of these tensors with three legs as the result of, as if they were a two-body unitary gate acting on two spins where one of the spins is always in state zero. Okay, we fix the we fix the index. Very well. So if we do that, I'm just going to replace all the tensor, all the isometries by in this way. Right? From here to here, I just made the replacement. And now I'm just going to stretch the zeros all the way up. And now I want to think of this. I would like you to think of this as a quantum circuit, which is doing the following. We start with n spins up here with no entanglement in a product state. Okay? That every spin is state 0, 0, 0. Every spin is state 0. And now what we're going to do is we're going to make them interact according to two spin gates. So for instance, these two spins starting at state 0 will interact according to this gate, afterwards, after which the two spins are no longer in a product state. They will be in an entangled state. And then you see a pattern of interactions or of gates, right? So afterwards, this spin goes here, and we get a fresh spin in state 0. And we also make them interact, and so on. And this happens in some way. There is some structure here that we can discuss in a minute. But the end result is that we produce a wave function of n spins where all the spins are entangled. Right? We start with n spins which are not entangled. We apply this circuit, and we end up with all the n spins entangled. And maybe the surprising fact is that I'm going to claim that the resulting state is a good ansatz. This defines a good variational class for ground states of one-dimensional systems. Okay? Just.
Why did you give it the name asymmetry?
Sorry?
Why did you call it asymmetry? Why?
Because it's embedding. So there is a context in which if you take a unitary matrix and you remove some of the columns, the resulting object is going to be called isometry. So it's not an isometry in the sense of general relativity. Okay. So, and then what we see is that this time of the computation, this is not physical time, it's just some auxiliary time that we use for in this construction. But what you can see is that the gates are introducing entanglement into the system at different times, or that actually means length scales. Okay, so up here we're introducing entanglement between, say, these two spins, which will end up affecting the whole system. Down here we're introducing entanglement which will only be short range, will only affect a local region of the spins. Sorry, what's that? Is that the philosophical point, or?
It's a fact. I mean, time is defined by, you know, instead of the Morocco limit, you go, you extend the locality of the crash to become more and more non-local than that.
Okay.
In the physical system.
So here?
Yeah, it's a mathematical time, physical time. It's just a remote.
Okay, so it's definitely not the physical time. It's just an auxiliary. And a view shared by several people now is that this can be interpreted in the continuum, at least, as an expansion in the Sitter space, right? So what you have is some expanding universe where more and more degrees of freedom come into play as the universe expands, and so this is represented by the spins that you are introducing in the state zero that only get into the picture at some later time.
The feature here is that your interaction is in non-local. So to make that picture work, you need to. I mean, what I'm saying is that the locality of your interaction decreases time. Right? So as time goes, the interaction becomes. If you take the locality to be your initial order,
right.
Then, you know, as time goes, it becomes more and more local. So you need a theory that.
I agree with you, so except.
The idea of the Sitter space is that modes which will be very long range at some point are born at a very early time. And there's local interaction between them, which produces a long range
effect. So you need time. To describe as a space time. I mean, for that it's fine, but if you want to have a space time picture, it's the exact
I'm not going to do that. Okay. Right. So I on purpose excluded all holography from this.
It's an interesting space time.
Okay.
It's one which is
No, it's exactly the time and the passing.
Right, but let's not talk about this now.
Okay,
so this, so that picture is just you know, it tells you what these type of states are, right? These are states that can, you can prepare through this quantum circuit. Okay. Now I want to think of the meta as a renormalization group transformation, or as a structure that incorporates a renormalization group transformation in it. And what I'm going to do first is to take Kalanov's spin blocking ideas, by means of which you take two spins, you have some original lattice, and you say, I'm going to constrain this lattice. So I'm going to take blocks of two spins and replace them with single spins. Now, there are many ways of doing that. I'm going to augment this with maybe the best variational strategy that we have, which is due to Steve White, which says just don't a priori constrain how you define this space in terms of the tensor product of this space. Just, you know, just wait. We'll ask the Hamiltonian variationally. We'll look at what minimizes the energy and so on. So there is a whole collection of such strategies. And what I want to point out, well, first I want to introduce another possible strategy, which would correspond to Mera, where we start with the blocking proposal. We still want to take two spins into one, blocks of two spins into one. But before we do that, we're going to allow this spin and these spins, these two spins are going to end up together. But this spin is going to be allowed to interact with a neighboring one through a unitary transformation. And that spin is also going to be allowed to interact with another one unitarily before these two are taken together. Okay? So we somehow introduce new possibilities into the game. We'll see why this could be useful. And then let's think about what we're trying to do here. We're trying to cross-grain our lattice system. Okay. In particular, there might be some ground state. And our goal is to actually get rid of irrelevant degrees of freedom, microscopic or short-range degrees of freedom, which do not affect the long-distance behavior of the system. And in particular, you could think that maybe this is going to be applied to a ground state that contains some entanglement between these two neighboring spins. Now, this entanglement between neighboring spins, since these two spins are going to become a single spin, this entanglement will disappear. So we're happy. This short-range entanglement will disappear, right? It's entanglement between two spins, which are now a single spin. There is no entanglement left. There are no correlations. The effective system does not inherit correlations due to this entanglement. In here, the same thing happens. Since these two spins are going to become the same one, the correlations will disappear, these short-range correlations. Now, let's assume, though, that there are also correlations, short-range correlations, between two spins which are going to be blocked into two different effective spins. Okay? Now is where the trouble starts. Because if we do that...
Sorry.
Yeah. This one here? This one here? This one?
Does it make a correlation?
Good point. This could happen. Okay? It could happen if we don't carefully choose these disentanglers, these unitaries, they could spread the entanglement. That's correct. Okay? But but for instance, if we choose them to be trivial, that won't happen. If these unitaries are chosen to do nothing, so they are identities, we're back to that.
Yeah, but if they entangled, they would necessarily spread. The river state is asking about the river state.
The what?
If they are not trivial, then the entanglement will spread. It will not localize.
You can choose them, so you may get to a compromise. Okay, so I'm not stating exactly what the form is going to be. I'm just adding degrees of freedom there, and they will allow me to do interesting things later on. Okay, so I'm not presenting a proof of anything, I'm just trying to give you an intuition.
Yeah,
so,
I guess what he's asking is that the bottom picture is very different from the first one. First one is that you remove short-term entanglement. The second one, you cannot spread it. You remove it.
I already agreed with that. That for a random choice of unitary transformations, this entanglement is going to spread. But we're not going to choose those disentanglers randomly. We're going to ask what these entanglements we have to put such that certain things happen. In particular, we don't want this spreading. Okay? It's a good point. I'm just saying that you have to take this as an intuitive description of what's going to happen. Look at those as giving you more possibilities, but we're not going to choose them randomly. We're going to choose them very carefully so that there is no these correlations here do not spread. Okay? Very good. So what I'm saying up here is that when we cross-grain these two spins and those two spins, the effective spins inherit the short distance correlations. Not only they inherit them, but actually those correlations become promoted to longer range correlations. They become nearest neighbor in the next length scale, in the new length scale, which is larger. Okay? So what this means is that such strategies clearly fail to remove some of the short range correlations, and that does not go well with the spirit of the randomization group flow, in which we would really like to remove all microscopic details which do not matter at long distances. Okay. Whereas here, So that's what I just said. We failed to remove some of the short range entanglement in the system. Whereas here, we could now still have at least a chance. Okay, that's all I'm trying to say, of using these disentanglers, choose these disentanglers such that this short range entanglement is removed. Right? And I'm going to leave it at that. It's at least it gives you a chance. And in practice, we see that in practice that this is what needed to be added to the scheme, so that, for instance, we recover scale invariance at criticality and so on. Okay? So the summary then is that a mirror contains, this is just one layer of the tensors in the mirror. Okay? And so you can think of the mirror as a stack of layers, each one performing a cross-grain transformation, where compared to the spin blocking strategies, we have added these disentanglers, which have want to play the role of removing all types of short range entanglement. Okay, so here we are. This tensor network gives you a wave function for the original lattice, but at the same time, it gives you also a sequence of wave functions, not just one, right? Because if we think of this as a cross-grain transformation, then when we apply that cross-grain transformation, it cancels the effect that we had there. So what you see is that we have not just one wave function, but a number of wave functions, one for the original lattice, one for the first cross-grain lattice, another for the second cross-grain lattice, and so on. Okay, so we had a sequence of wave functions. Okay. So what we see then is that MIRA actually defines an RG flow in the space of wave functions, in the sense that I just mentioned. And so in particular, when you use these ansatz to approximate the ground state of a given local Hamiltonian, what you see is that, for instance, if the Hamiltonian is at the critical point, this structure is self-similar. Actually, you see that you can choose all these tensors in one layer and in the next layer and in the next layer and so on to be identical. Okay? So scale invariance is explicitly realized. But if this was not at the critical point, what you would see instead, so if we were not at the critical point, then we would actually see that the wave function is flowing towards another type of state. And in particular, after a finite number of layers, we'll see that the resulting wave function is almost a product state or not entangled. For instance, if we were in the critical, in the Ising model, and we had a strong magnetic field, a magnetic field larger than the critical one, or smaller than the critical one, then we would see a flow towards a wave function which is much less entangled.
Sorry, I have a question. Does scale invariance mean that the wave functions are the same, or that the tensors are the same, or is that
both,
the same?
Both. Okay. So at criticality, you see that both the tensor and the wave function. So at criticality, we study directly the thermodynamic limit. There are infinitely many layers going up. Okay, and when you try to optimize them, you realize you can make the choice of making them all identical. Okay, and that automatically means that for any lattice that you choose, the wave function looks the same. Partition functions will come later.
Criticality and these things that you're talking about now are with respect to what?
Quantum criticality. So at zero temperature, I tune my quantum Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but where is that? Is quantum combinator or?
I'm sorry.
Where is the quantum Hamiltonian? Where
oh, so that could be the critical Ising model. Transverse field Ising model.
So this choice is hidden in the tensors.
In the tensors.
Right, so there is an optimization procedure here, which I haven't described. Okay. So I decided not to list, you know, to put more numbers. I started with some concrete example, precisely for the Ising model, a criticality with the CFT. We saw that the wave function accurately approximates the what you expect from the field theory perspective. All the correlations are in place with the right scaling dimensions. And so now I'm not describing the optimization process. Okay.
I've heard several of your talks, and sometimes
sorry
also,
about that.
No, I'm trying to understand what this removal of short-range entanglement. Wouldn't you expect that just naively that some entanglement should be like survive also on a longer, on a larger scale?
Sure.
But it. Like, with which of your assumptions of your program is this colliding? And I mean, I suspect that it is that you want to have this scale invariance at a finite one dimension, right?
Yes.
That you want to keep your efficient description. I think this is why you want to remove this perfect entanglement. But still, at criticality, you should still, in principle, to capture everything, you should still have, like, infinite one dimension. Like
yes, but not. But yes, but not in the sense. So an exact solution to an exact.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to reproduce all scaling dimensions of the theory, there are infinitely many, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the primary fields and infinite towers of descendants. So the only way we would be able to do that would be with infinite bond dimension.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But that doesn't mean accumulating all short range entanglement forever. These are two different questions. And we do not want to accumulate short-range entanglement. Intuitively, what's happening here is that by removing short-range entanglement, we truly lift the cutoff. So usually we think, oh, we have a lattice. The cutoff, UV cutoff is given by the lattice spacing. That's the intuitive thought, right? But actually, if you take your system with on the lattice, and you simply join together sites, groups of two sites, if you do just spin blocking, you actually haven't, you have changed your lattice spacing, but you have not removed details that correspond to the previous length scale. You still have these short-range correlations, okay? So you can understand the removal of short-range correlations as truly lifting the cutoff to the next length scale. And then the recovery of a scale invariance, what you are saying is, well, I change length scale and I've consistently change the cutoff. Now I get the same effective picture at the new length scale. Good. Right, so, very good. So I used to get this a lot. Oh, you have an RG flow in the space of wave functions. That sounds exotic, very nice, but you know, we don't care about this. We would like to have an RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians. That's what we understand. That's where the literature, that's what we've learned from the literature. And so, as a matter of fact, the mirror also defines an RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians, of local Hamiltonians, and that's not difficult to understand. So what I'm going to say now is that, of course, we have a cosherine transformation. Every layer of the mirror is a cosherine transformation that takes you from one lattice to the next one. So let's just use this cosherine transformation to transform local operators. So here what you have is a local operator acting on three spins, okay, and non-trivially on three spins, as the identity on the rest of the spins at the original lattice. And we're just going to use this cosherine transformation to map this local operator into an operator on the cosherine lattice, right? We act with the cosherine transformation and by conjugation. And this part here looks like something went wrong, because here what we have is a three-body operator. Originally, we had only a non-trivial operator acting on three spins, but here effectively it seems to be acting on all the spins on the new lattice. But actually, we just need to remember that these were unitary gates. This is U and this is U dagger. U times U dagger disappear, they cancel. So there are cancellations in most places except near the insertion or near the operator. And after we've removed all these disentanglers, the isometries also remember that they multiply to the identity. And so the net result is that we have actually that the original local operator acting on three spins has become a local operator acting also on three spins in the on the Cosgrain lattice. Okay, so this Cosgrain transformation preserves locality. When you cosgrain a local operator, you obtain a local operator. And so that's all we needed. You take your local Hamiltonian now, you cosgrain it, it's a sum of local terms. When you cosgrain, you get a sum of local terms. And so we have that this cosgrain transformation also defines an RG flow in the space of local operators. Okay? So that made some people happy at some point, that we also had the classical picture. But I think the wave function picture is more interesting because, in particular, it contains the Hamiltonian picture.
And does this probably survive? So in this example that you have given, the Hamiltonian acts on the tensor product of three Hilbert spaces. And does this, is this true?
So if you had four spins, it will reduce to three. If you had 70, it will reduce progressively. Cosgrain by cosgrain into until it stabilizes at three. So one of the properties you have here is that in the original Wilson's RG, when you integrate the shell of momentum and so on, you generate all types of couplings, including arbitrary derivatives and longer distances and so on. Here you just get three site operators. You start with a local Hamiltonian, and 20 iterations later, after cosgraining 20 times, you still have just three site operators. Okay, so let me summarize and then we can move to the second part. So I've been discussing this tensor network called Mera. I told you the variational parameters for different, so you can store variational parameters for different length scales at different places in the network. As a quantum circuit, what we saw is that we are preparing a state here, which we will use as ANSET for a ground state, which is the result of an evolution or a quantum circuit where entanglement is introduced at different length scales, okay, progressively. And as an RG transformation, we've seen that it produces an RG transformation for wave functions, but also for Hamiltonians. For wave functions, the logo was that we are removing short-range entanglement. Okay, that's the idea that made the difference with respect to previous proposals. And as a Hamiltonian, as an RG on transformation for Hamiltonians, what we say is that it preserves locality. And, you know, this is just theoretical discussion, and the question is, does it work? And now I just have to go back to showing you the results that I explained before, and I'll add just a little touch so that you know where the results are coming from. So, again, in this case, we start with the 1D quantum Hamiltonian, say the criticalizing model. And then there is an optimization through energy minimization and some, you know, details that you can find in the literature, but I don't want to bother you with. After the optimization, we have this tensor network, which is the same as before. This is the Mera, just looking at it from the top. After the optimization, we can extract. So this is now an approximation to the ground state. In this case, to the ground state of a critical theory. Okay, and from the optimized tensor, then we can extract the information that we want. And in particular, I told you that you can extract the conformal data. And just to give you insight into one of the details, remember that we understood that local operators are cross-grained into local operators. Okay, so you take these tensors, the optimized tensors, and you use them as a cross-grained transformation. So now you can ask the question, OK, so given a local, let me look for local operators that are mapped and the cross-grained into themselves. You can ask the question, are there local operators that are mapped into themselves? Basically, what you have here is a linear map, right? You have an operator, you apply these tensors, you get another operator, it's a linear map, so you just have to take this linear map and diagonalize it. And if you do that, you obtain every eigenvector corresponds to a scaling field of the theory, every eigenvalue will tell you about the scaling dimension. Okay? So that's an example of, that's how we obtain all these numbers.
How do you expect the OPD?
The OP is a bit more complicated. So once you have identified these scaling operators, right, the eigenvectors of this linear map here, then what you ask is, if I take two of these scaling operators, when under cosgraining, so you place one here, the other there on the lattice, under cosgraining they get closer. So when they are nearest neighbor, under cosgraining they'll fuse. And you ask, you know, let's write the fusion in terms of the scaling operators of the theory. You can rewrite that, and that gives you the OP. Okay? So we go directly.
Start farther away, get a more precise evaluation.
No, these scaling operators are, they really just transform, right? So it doesn't matter how far away you start, you'll get exactly the same result. Everything happens on the lattice. That's the interesting part. Good. And so things you can, so these are numbers that we saw before. And so we've been using this over the years to, for instance, in 1+1 critical systems, we use this scheme to also study impurities, defects, boundaries, interfaces. For critical systems, there are lots of things you can do with Mera. And also in 2+1 dimensions, we can write wave functions of topologically ordered systems exactly in terms of Mera. We can study frustrated spins, interacting fermions. So that's interesting because tensor networks do not have sine problems, so we don't struggle with the same problems that quantum Monte Carlo will have. We have our own problems, of course. Okay, very good. So that's the first part, and I think we're fine because the second part is substantially shorter. Are there questions?
It's a fundamental question. When you speak about entanglement, that depends on the operator that you apply to the wave function, right? So if you're given a particular state vector, it doesn't make sense to define entanglement. It depends on what kind of Hamiltonian you apply to it. Is that
no, when I talk about entanglement here, what I'm thinking is that I have a tensor product structure in my Hilbert space. My Hilbert space is the tensor product of sides, say, of the vector space for each side. And for me, entanglement there is departure from having a product state where each side has its own wave function.
Okay, that's independent.
Yes, entanglement to me only refers to a tensor product structure in the Hilbert space. You specify the tensor product structure, and with respect to that product structure, you have product or unentangled states, and then the rest are entangled states. Very good. So let's go to the second part then. Now I want to switch to partition functions. That's fine. All I'm saying is, given a tensor product, there might be some relation, but given a tensor product structure, you could have many Hamiltonians described on that tensor product structure.
Yeah, but if you take the wrong one, a local Hamiltonian could be very non-local.
Okay.
That would not be efficient.
Fair enough. I'm just saying that you can define a Hilbert space without defining a Hamiltonian and a tensor product structure. But yes, there might be a relation with the Hamiltonian. Very good. So classical partition functions or Euclidean path integrals. So you know well that, so I'm now going to go to quantum systems again in 1D, but I'm going to consider Euclidean time, okay? Or classical systems in two dimensions, statistical partition function in two dimensions, and so we'll have space x direction and y direction. And you know that these two objects are closely related to each other. Yes? Sure. I did not describe that.
So I was wondering what's the dependence of all this procedure on the cutoff chi?
Chi acts as a refinement parameter. So the larger chi, the more accurate the result will be. But also the computational cost will grow as some power of chi. So usually what we do is start with small chi. We optimize for small chi. Then those tensors can be enlarged to larger chi, right? So we embed the small tensors into larger ones, and then you optimize for larger one dimension.
Is it that if you take a small chi, it still converges to some other values?
Okay, so for any value of chi, you get some value of the... What's nice about this scheme is that for any value of chi, you already get scale invariance. but it's the wrong, you get the wrong critical exponents and so on, right? So the larger the bond dimension, the more accurate the scaling dimensions come out. And you pay a larger computational price. Right? Good, so let me then go to Euclidean path integrals and statistical partition functions. And so the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to write the partition function or the Euclidean path integral of a lattice model as a tensor network. But this is not an ansatz. This time, this is not an ansatz. Every Euclidean path integral properly, so we're going to have to discretize time in the Euclidean path integral. But other than that, or any lattice a statistical partition function on the lattice can be actually represented as a tensor network in an exact or quasi-exact way. And this is the starting point, not just for the method I'll describe, but for a number of other methods that have been proposed before. And so just to give you an idea of how this works, for the Euclidean path integral, say that you take the Ising model. This is the 1D quantum Ising model at criticality, so magnetic field with coefficient 1. And so all you do is you take the exponential of this Hamiltonian with some beta, and then you break it into pieces. So you use what's called a trotter, Suzuki trotter decomposition. And this automatically gives you something that looks like a tensor network. Okay. So this is standard of the shelf. I just wrote it as a quantum circuit where these gates are not unitary, but they are actually small gates, Euclidean time gates. And so you can write this Euclidean evolution operator just like that. And then you just, you do some nasty stuff locally. You take your tensors, you break them using singular valid decompositions and whatever, and you write it as a tensor network. Okay? So I'm just rewriting the partition function as a tensor network. No magic involved, nothing. We haven't made any conjecture or anything. So similarly, it's even easier for the statistical partition function, say for the Ising model. So now imagine that these are the spins on my lattice for the classical Ising model. And the Hamiltonian is just given by sum over pairs of spins. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to define a tensor A for my tensor network in terms of just putting together four of these Boltzmann weights. So the Boltzmann weight between I and J, J and K, K and L and I, I just put them together. So I just gave you an analytical expression for this tensor, okay? So this is, again, something that you can always do. And you get your tensor network. It's an exact representation of the partition function that you want to talk about, okay? So tensor networks at this stage have been used just to rewrite the problem. You don't need criticality, you don't need anything, yes. Good. And so once we've written the partition function as a tensor network, or in this case, the Euclidean path integral as a tensor network, what I would like to do, something went wrong there, okay, whatever. What I want to do is I want to take this tensor network and coarse grain it, okay? I want to define a coarse grain transformation, a renormalization group transformation on this tensor network. And again, I want it to be a proper one in the sense that it should match what we expect from the continuum. In particular, if this is a critical system, we would like to recover explicitly scale invariance. But for the time being, just what we're trying to do is to define some coarse-grain transformation that will take blocks of four spins and will replace, four sites, four tensors, and replace them with a single tensor, and we will iterate. Okay. So you see where this is going. We're going to have a flow in the space of tensors now, which looks even worse than the space of wave functions. Okay. So, so this is the part where I will briefly introduce the method that we proposed recently. We call it tensor network renormalization. It looks scary. It is what it is. And I'll describe it in a second, but if you want to learn this type of things, there is Glenn Evenly recently, so my collaborator recently posted, I think last week, a paper with all the details, algorithmic details that you need in order to actually make this run. Okay? But all we have to take from here is that we have some transformation. We're going to take four tensors on our tensor network, describing the partition function. We just locally take a piece of it, a chunk of it, and we'll make some replacement according to some rules, where whatever we replace this for should be approximately the same. So you see here as a tensor network, locally, this has 8 open legs. And we're going to, and so it describes, if you want, a vector in a 8-fold vector space or a tensor or whatever you want to think of. And we're going to replace it with another tensor network, which also has 8 open legs. And it should really be closely related to this one. So if you take this 8-leg operator and you subtract this one, you should, the norm of this should be very close to 0. Okay, that's the condition that we are going to impose. And so this is a replacement. Then we rewrite things in a, you know, we just keep making local replacements. And that looks complicated. And there is no point in going more into detail. But I want to tell you what happens when you compose this. So here we take blocks of 4 tensors. We make the replacements that I just described. You find that there is a unitary transformation U here and a unitary transformation there that disappears. So from here to here, we just cancel these disentanglers that have been introduced. Then we make another replacement, magic, another one. And now we have some isometries, W, W dagger, which also cancel. Okay, and once they cancel, you get to a tensor network in here. So a lot of strange things happening. The net result is that we go from the partition function with tensors at the microscopic scale to an effective tensor network with tensors A prime instead of A that describes the same system at another length of scale. And the important thing is that this is equal to that. Okay, this tensor network was representing the partition function. This also represents the partition function up to the small errors that we have introduced in the replacements.
So the way you describe that seems to be very dependent on the fact that you lattice square. Mm. But what if it's really more randomized than that?
So for any regular lattice, you can cook up a scheme. For a random,
it has to be linear.
Right.
Can get out of
if it's not, so this movement, this replacement are completely local, right? So in principle, you could just consider an irregular lattice. It takes some patience to do that, right? What we can do here is go directly to the thermodynamic limit, since we are doing the same thing everywhere. Mm-hmm. If you had an irregular lattice, you will have to think carefully what you do at each region.
You might not even have criticality on some irregular lattices.
You may not. That's again, this is not only for critical systems.
Sorry, this algorithm seems to treat x and y direction differently. Is that important, or is that just some accident?
Good point. It's actually, we have a scheme which treats both directions completely identical. Mm-hmm. It's just that we realize that we could simplify it and still get the same effect that we wanted. And so this is a simplified version of the completely isotropic scheme, isotropic on the lattice. So yes, with respect to 90-degree rotations. That's a good point. In the Euclidean path integral, you could think that maybe, you know, if you don't have a Lorentz invariant theory or whatever, if you write that the two directions are also already not equivalent space and time, but right, we insisted in trying to get isotropy, and it can be done. It's just not the schema. I think this is complex enough. Yes. All right. So proposal. Now you apply it, and what do you get? So we applied being very original to the 2D classical Ising model, and what I'm going to do is the following. So we get a sequence of tensors A, A prime, A second, and so on, okay, by cosigning this partition function expressed as a tensor network. And let me tell you what happens when we're slightly below critical temperature, okay, for the 2D classical Ising model. So here, what I'm plotting is a tensor. Now, this is a 4-leg tensor. So I'm just joining 2 legs and 2 legs. Now I get a 2-index tensor, so a matrix. Okay? And what I'm plotting here is the components of this tensor, of this matrix. So when you look at here and you see dark spots, these are coefficients in this matrix that are very close to 0. And when you see white is as close, well, the largest values that you have. And then anything in between, the different colors, tells you that you have some non-vanishing numbers there. What we see is that as we constrain the system, once, twice, three times, and so on, that this quickly converges to some metrics or tensor, and after which this is a fixed point tensor. Nothing else happens afterwards. Okay. So what we see is that in the space of tensor, there is an energy flow to a fixed point. And I'll get back to that one in a second. Now what we can do also, of course, is to start at the critical temperature. Now, remember this tensor was built out of the Boltzmann weights, right? And the Boltzmann weights depend continuously on the temperature. So it's not surprising that the initial tensors look very similar. We just went from 0.9 times the critical temperature to the critical temperature. So the Boltzmann weights have not changed a lot. Locally, the system looks very similar. But as you cosgrain, what we see is that the behavior now is very, very different. The cosgrain transformation gives you back essentially the same tensor over and over again. Okay? And so what's happening is that indeed we have recovered a critical fixed point. We have a scale invariance, again, at the level of the lattice. Okay?
Everywhere in the
each A originally was the product of four Boltzmann weights. Okay? We had four spins, and we just take the Boltzmann weights for those four spins, connecting pairs of four. So we have four pairs of spins.
That's the A, and it connects to the
other A's. That's the A. And this is a matrix. So when you have this tensor with four legs, I just put two legs together and two legs together. That gives you a matrix.
Yes, and
this coarse graining makes like a blocking of the A's.
I'm sorry.
This coarse graining.
What I did then. So what I did was I took blocks of four tensors A. I introduced local manipulations that effectively replace those four tensors A with a single tensor A prime, or A1 into A2, A2 into A3, and so on. Okay, so this defines this cosine transformation in the space, or RG flow in the space of tensors, and now I'm just seeing that indeed it has the properties that you would expect. When you are below the critical temperature, it flows to a given fixed point. What I should add is that it doesn't matter what the initial temperature is, if it's below the critical temperature, the initial tensor will look different, but we always flow to the same fixed point.
Maybe to emphasize the point, which I will emphasize in my talk also, because you said you block the tensors. So you block the tensors, but you do more than just blocking the very intersection. So this is much more non-trivial than just blocking the spins. Mm-hmm. And the entire thing is here that you do lots of non-trivial variable transformation, so that the final representation is the simplest one, which
right.
You see there.
Thanks. So yes, Bianca, I think I wonder, that's the way to phrase it. So you can think of this as blocking, and then some field redefinition, change of variables, which is not completely local. It's not affecting just the variable on one index. It affects a small neighborhood. Okay?
Yeah. And so this allows you to get this fixed point, which looks like a fixed point, but it comes from, you know, very far away from the fixed point. So it's not, okay, I will say it's usually a confusing point, which I was confused about this for some time. It's not that it means you are at zero temperature, you started at zero temperature, but you did lots of variable transformation.
Of course.
So that your model looks now.
Right. If we started at zero temperature, if we started at zero temperature, you would get directly this guy from the start. Right. But that's what the RG flow is doing, right? It's forgetting where it's coming from. It just remembers in which phase you were. So that's what it's drawing here. You are flowing towards the fixed point, right?
You mean that the plots at the bottom there are relative, like the different colors are relative to each other?
Yes.
When you go from different squares, they have different overall scales.
we have renormalized the tensors such that if you go to CFT, you see that the partition function has a universal part, and there is a non-universal part, which is extensive, or it's exponential of the system size. You kill that one off, and then you are left. So with that normalization, you get this. Otherwise, I mean, if we don't fix the normalization, we would get something here, and this would be times 3, and this would be times 9, and you know there will be a constant that is an exponentially large constant in there. Yes.
The variable transformations that you apply in cost training, could you determine them ahead of time by looking at the Hamiltonian?
No.
Or do you have to do that dynamically
no.
every time?
Once we're here, once we've put codified things into tensor network, the Hamiltonian, of course, is present in here. But we don't know the Hamiltonian anymore. So this is handled in the same way, whether it was a quantum system, a classical system. Okay, the information is encoded here, but this replacement is done optimizing something numerically.
Do you have to optimize that, or could you do something just using the thumb ahead of time?
That
don't optimize.
Right, that's the point of this approach. We don't want to say spin blocking. Proceeds by what's that majority vote, right? We don't think that you know that's sufficiently universal in general, and why should the spins vote? I mean, So what
oh,
we have,
there could be something else, right? It couldn't be
okay. So right. So what we do here is simply here is an object, okay, which is part of by composition gives you the partition function you are interested in. Let's take this object and replace it with something that is very close to it. So that we don't affect the partition function.
But you do the dynamical optimization to
absolutely. And that's why so for instance, the coarse graining, the actual tensors involved in here, in these intermediate steps, they are not the same when we're dealing with below critical temperature or at the critical temperature. They are decided on the spot. You have this four tensors, A, and you ask, what do I need to replace this with, such that the replacement is legal, right? Such that I only introduce a very small error. And so, you know, the machine tells you. It's a function of the temperature, of course.
So I'm, in my head, trying to compare that to numerical methods that exist, and they are constructed in the other way, that you look at the operator that you're trying to solve, and then deriving from that operator, you would derive how to coarse grain your system. And there's nothing locally optimized. So that seems to be a fundamental difference. There.
So for us, the only input is locality. Okay? Any local Hamiltonian will go into this.
Maybe I can comment because I did the classical part and was the quantum part. And so the classical part, you can actually do what you say, and you get reasonable results.
For which model?
And for scalar field.
Right.
In the classical thing. The thing is that the classical thing, the flow behaves very differently. There's the quantum part, there's this criticality things, which means if you don't do the right thing, you much more easily flow to the wrong thing.
Okay.
So here, if you predetermine your maps, you actually flow to what you predetermined.
But this is an important. Here we don't want to determine where we're going to go. We want to ask the system, where do you want to go?
Yeah,
right?
that's my point. I mean,
right.
So I'm saying if you predetermine your point there in the quantum system, you predetermine where you flow, which is a wrong thing. So
you get critical exponents for another fixed point, which is not.
You
can say yes, my computer flew in that direction, but that doesn't mean
you do a completely wrong.
Okay,
that's what I'm saying.
Right. Okay, so what happens if we are above criticality? Well, again, we just change the temperature a little bit. So this tensor, again, looks very similar to this one, which looks similar to that one. Okay, Boltzmann weights are a continuous function of the temperature. But now as you coarse grain, you go to a new fixed point. Okay, and this fixed point is just one element of the tensor is non-zero. Okay. Good, very good question. So disordered fixed point, just one non-vanishing element, that makes sense. All the spins are maximally disordered or whatever, however you want to think. But they are all the same. In the ordered fixed point, you are actually keeping a copy of each possible realization. So This point corresponds to all spins up. This point corresponds to all spins down. These tensors are telling neighboring spins, what do you do? Oh, I'm going up. OK, so if you are up, I'm going to be up. OK, that's this point here, which is also the same that you would have down here. But in the order fixed point, the spins also say, well, actually, no, now I'm going to go down. OK, everybody down. OK, so you could think of this tensor as the direct sum of two copies of this one. OK?
In your order of higher order fixed point, like three?
You could have the system, right. So if it was not the Ising model, you could have other fixed ones, yes. And we've applied this to say the POTS model, tricritical. Well, tricritical, no, it's work in progress. POTS model, yes. You can do that.
Leader model also has the symmetry that if you flip all spins at the same time, you get the same partition number, you get the same number. So do you keep track of the symmetry explicitly? Or because you
we do, we do. We do, and that's not important to this talk.
Yeah. Use it for optimization of the code.
That's right. But
so I have something to talk about tomorrow.
Absolutely. I didn't touch symmetries on purpose, because the point is that symmetries are a next layer that you can add on top of this, but that the essence, the essential complications on doing an RG step, RG transformation, are not necessarily related or are come before talking about symmetries. And symmetries actually can make it a bit more complicated, but then you can exploit them to get more accuracy. So there is some trade-off there. But the essential ingredients can be discussed without symmetries. Very good. So I think, well, let me mention also that there was previous work by Gu and Wen in 2009 on another method, which was able also to recover the two non-critical fixed points. So what's new is that we can actually recover also the critical one. And then I think that, 5 minutes, so I'm just going to stop. Let me mention just one thing, OK? So I'm going to talk about, let me tell you that there is a close relation between between the two parts of the talk, OK? So the first part of the talk, I was talking about an ansatz, the mirror, which is an ansatz that we propose to describe wave functions. In the second part of the talk, I discuss how to coarse-grain the Euclidean path integral, OK? But of course, we know that the Euclidean path integral or an Euclidean time evolution prepares the ground state, right? In particular, so if you take the Euclidean time evolution on the upper half plane, then on the x-axis, you have prepared the ground state. Or if you put it on a strip, an infinite strip of width beta, then the Euclidean path integral or the Euclidean time evolution prepares a thermal state and so on. So these are well-known facts. And now what we did was, well, let's take the upper half plane and let's repeat what we did before. So this is the Euclidean time evolution, okay, that I discussed before, these tensors. These arrows indicate that this extends indefinitely to the left, to the right, and above. But now here we have a boundary. So we took our tensor network, which was on the plane. We put a cat on the real axis, and we throw away half of it, okay? And we're left with this object. Now, this object is the ground state of the system, of the quantum system. This is the exponential of minus. This is the exponential of minus tau h for very large tau. So this is the ground state, okay? And so we have the representation of the ground state. And now we can apply the same tensor network renormalization scheme that we discussed before. And you see, as before, no news, it's still a mess. But what you see is that compared to the previous mess, is that here you have U and U daga. So from here to here, these two tensors disappear, right? The green guys that populate all the upper half plane are gone everywhere except near the boundary. Why are they still at the boundary? Well, this guy was meant to cancel with a guy from the lower half plane. But the lower half plane is not there, OK? So we're left. Compared to before, we're left with this row of these entanglers. Now we keep coarse-graining, and now we have isometries, right? And pairs of isometries, they cancel. They cancel everywhere except near the boundary, of course, because you know they were meant to cancel with somebody on the lower half plane, but we are not introducing. We don't have anything below. And so what you see is that effectively we go from a tensor network on the upper half plane in terms of tensor A to a tensor network for the upper half plane, in terms of A prime as before. Nothing has changed, except that now we have a row of disentanglers and a row of isometries. And this row of disentanglers and isometries, you can see they are connecting the original indices of, and the original length scale to the Cochrane indices at the next length scale. Okay? And so I think you see this one coming. This was one step. That's a summary of one step. And now you can Cochrane again, as usual, this tensor network, the blue part of the tensor network, and you'll get from A prime to A prime double prime, and two layers of disentanglers and isometries. And if you continue to do that, what do you get? Well, you get a mera. Okay, that's a mera. So mera appears as a byproduct of tensor network renormalization when you take this, the partition function, and you put it only on the upper half plane, and you leave all these open indices. Now, the point here is that this was the ground state. We started from the ground state. Okay, remember, this is Euclidean time evolution. This prepares the ground state. Okay, this is part here. So this goes to the ground state. We have the ground state, and we just locally Cochrane the tensor network representation of the ground state, and we obtain a mirror. Okay, so we were quite excited about this, because for almost 10 years we were taking the mirrors as a variational ansatz, right? So you start with all, you put the tensors there, and you have all the variational parameters, and in inside the tensors, and through some energy optimization, which I did not describe today, we would obtain an approximation to the ground state, or what we thought maybe was an approximation to the ground state. Now what we do is very different. Now we start with a representation of the ground state. This is the Euclidean evolution, right? So this is a quasi-exact representation of the ground state. And what we do is we Cochrane this tensor network representation to obtain a mera. Okay? So it's very different. And so in particular, before, apart from the fact that it would take forever, once you get your optimized tensor network, you don't really know whether this is the ground state or not. It's, you know, it's your best guess given this variational class and your optimization procedure, but you don't have a way to check whether that's really the ground state. Now that's very different, because we started from the ground state. We were not searching for the ground state. We had it. We just rewrote it in terms of another tensor network. Okay, and so at each iteration in going from here to here, at each iteration we make small replacements. We may be introducing errors. We can quantify those errors. Right? When we take a block of four tensors and we replace it with something else, we can take the norm of the difference and say, okay, we just introduced an error, you know, 10 to the minus 6 in this, at this point. And we can add all the errors. And if all the errors are sufficiently small, we can guarantee that this is an approximation to the true ground state within some accuracy. And then you can repeat the same trick, but for a strip, and you get a thermal mera. And that's also even more exciting, because this is a representation of a thermal state. You cannot get this guy by trying to minimize the energy, right? The ground state, you can get it by minimizing variationally an energy, but not a thermal state. So what we did again here is we have this infinite strip of finite width beta that is already a representation of the thermal state. And what we do is we Cochrane this tensor network, and we obtain another representation of the same thermal state. And maybe that's not clear, but the difference between the representation and this representation is that from this one, we can efficiently extract correlators, observables, anything that we want. Very good. So I'll stop here. Let me go to the conclusions. So I'm skipping local scale transformations. So summary and conclusions. We've reformulated. The whole program was about reformulating Wilson's RG ideas using quantum information tools and concepts. We've been talking about quantum circuits and entanglement. And that was useful, because by focusing our attention on entanglement, we understood that that was what needed to be removed. Short-range entanglement was, removing short-range entanglement was the key to making progress. And we obtained this efficient representation of ground states, the mera. And we've obtained three proper RC transformations. Proper in the sense that they are consistent with the expectations that you have from the continuum in terms of a structure of fixed points and so on. So tensors. In the space of tensors, we've seen that we have a properly behaved flow. Now, the good news is I just told you that tensor network renormalization, which produces this flow, also produces a mera, right? So if you are not happy with having a flow in the space of tensors, actually you also got for free the wave functions, okay? Because tensor normalization, renormalization produces also flow, the meta, which describes the flow in the space of wave functions. And we also saw that from the wave function, we could obtain a flow in the space of Hamiltonians. Okay, so we obtain these other flows, which maybe were not as expected, but they are connected, and they ultimately allow you to get also your RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians. The key ingredient in all this was removal of short-range entanglement. And we've seen that this meta, and actually I didn't show you the results, but TNR also produces very accurate results in 1+1 dimensions. But what about higher dimensions? That's one of the things that we would like to look, we should be looking very carefully at. And then one question for you is, well, where is the continuum limit in all these constructions, okay? We always work on the lattice, right? You may think, oh yes, but in the lattice you can look at long distances. You can do that and define that as the continuum limit if you want. But actually, you can cause rain. And while staying in the lattice, these long distances will become short distances. And so you can think of ways of talking about the continuum limit, but you don't need to. Everything can work on the lattice. Okay? And so that's something that I thought that might be relevant to your interest. Okay, thanks.
Time for some questions. We have quite some already.
I have a question, maybe looking forward. I mean, here you talked about, let's say, you know, spin system, no spin system, neural dimension. Some other systems that, you know, we knew how to deal with for a long time. If I think about the challenge, the challenge that lie ahead, what would be the interesting system? The things that we are still trying to, you know, struggle to understand what is the background function. It's Young's theory. Okay. So Young's theory, of course, you need two upgrades. One is the symmetry, BT symmetry. And the other thing is that the only thing we know about Young's is that somehow the wave function is going to get simpler if we have large n, which kind of goes against your technique where you need low spin. So is there a possibility to improve it so that somehow it's able? I mean, the challenge is to the symmetry you can see, well, you know, it's been networks, more cumbersome, but you can deal with it. But the larger end needs.
Okay, the two aspects are related. So symmetries, indeed, we've been dealing with symmetries for many years. I just excluded that from this presentation because I thought they were not relevant or essential. Mm-hmm. But indeed, we can. Okay, thanks. So we can do SU2, we can do quantum groups. So we've generalized this approach to even anion statistics. So the degrees of freedom are anionic, and that can be represented in terms of quantum groups. So there is a systematic way of doing that, of incorporating symmetries. These are internal symmetries, both global and local. We can also do gauge symmetries or gauge theories, okay, on the lattice. Now, what happens is every time you have the more symmetry you have, the more simplifications take place. So on the one hand, you have that maybe for large n, the limit, large n limit, you'll have many more degrees of freedom. I can already tell you that the cost grows exponentially in the central charge, so exponentially in your n or n squared, right? So the computational cost would grow very fast, but at the same time, you have more symmetry. And that every time you have symmetry, you can exploit it to reduce the computational cost. So there is a trade-off there. And we don't know. Yeah. We don't know in which direction it will go.
Is there a back of the envelope evaluation that tells you that the trade-off could be stabilized, or that it's, or
it's a very good question. I don't know the answer.
Okay. I have another question. In your renormalization group flow, what was basically flowing were all the tensors. And that means all the space of models were given by the space of different coefficients of making C the same. Yeah. That's a bit like what I wrote on yesterday, where I said, well, general spin network functions is just you choose operators without thinking too much about it. Now, if I wanted to say, well, I don't want to flow this set of all models, but I just want to have a certain parameterized set, like at least 5 public constants.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to either do that in your approach or to say, well, if you restrict yourself to this 5-dimensional subset instead of running all tensors, you're not making it too large a mistake with large errors. Is there a way of a connection between saying, between what you do and say a person says, well, I want to have public
right.
logical constant, a music parameter, and Newton's constant?
So it's true that the first reaction when you have these tensors, which look very impersonal and you forgot, you don't know how to read the physics and so on, the first reaction is, whoa, let me slow down and you know go back to a subset of parameters so that at least I know the physical meaning of those parameters. And actually in tensor networks, there have been, so some researchers have tried to do that and successfully, to restrict your tensor network to a subset of parameters
mm-hmm.
that correspond to something that was already understood before, for instance. But I would say that, yeah, this is possible, but that goes against the philosophy.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity to let go of your restricted set of parameters. And of course you want to learn how to extract the information afterwards. Of course, if I tell you, oh, look, nice flow in the space of I don't know what, right? So it's nice, but I don't know what it is, right? So, but in the end, you can read, for instance, from the fixed point tensors. Let's see, this is the stuff that I didn't talk about. So if we go back to the isomorph, if we come back here, if I look at this tensor, actually, now I can go back to the symmetry. There is a Z2 symmetry, okay? And if I see how it acts, it will exchange these 2 points. And this is actually all you need to know to get the essential features of the fixed point, which is that you have symmetry breaking, you have 2 points, right, each of which is mapping to the other through the symmetry. I mean, that's how you know there is symmetry breaking. Here, we apply the Z2 symmetry and this stays stable. This point here stays stable. This one and these 2 points are being exchanged. So it takes some effort to learn to read out of these tensors, but they actually contain all the information that you want. The universal information that you want. You've thrown away lots of things in the process. You've thrown away all the non-universal part.
But I mean, here in this tensor on the left-hand side, what you've done is you've started from a tensor which comes from e to the minus
yes.
beta h, and then you've chosen specific values of beta.
Yes.
Now, let's say I don't do that, but I just have all the matrix coefficients. I'm looking in all that space, and then I find this critical point, and I say, that's great. And now I ask myself, now what's the value of the critical temperature? Is there a way to just look at this box of numbers and recalculate what
but
the temperature
I don't
is?
Understand your question. You said you start with a random tensor?
Right. I just say,
so
well, I look at the space of
so
all tensors.
So from the beginning, mm-hmm. what is the temperature?
Well, the tensor is only a box of numbers, and all of these things that are happening are just unitary transformations. So do you need to specify temperatures there already to do that?
The space of tensors is larger than the space of exponentials of Hamiltonians.
Yes, that's right. My question is, if I have just this tensors, is there a way to rewrite back in something which, like e to the minus beta h?
If you knew that it was coming from e to the minus beta h?
I don't know, maybe I don't. I mean,
right, right. No, but I'm saying
in
general, this inversion problem has no solution because... There are tricks you can play. So the log directly on a tensor, it's not going to work because it's not very well defined. But what you can do is you can take a transfer matrix. Okay, and from the transfer matrix, you can diagonalize that. And then you can you can identify a Hamiltonian there. If there is a Hamiltonian. I'm not answering this quickly because if I understand you properly, you're saying, oh, let's start with tensors, with random coefficients. I don't know if there is a Hamiltonian.
What do you mean by starting with a tensor? I mean, is it an answer for a solution? Or is there a solution you're looking to determine the system? Or what is it?
No, what I understand is that this prescription is giving you a flow in the space of tensors, right? So you can ask yourself, well, what is a fixed point on this flow? There's no physics yet. It's just boxes of numbers.
Yeah, but it's not arbitrary tensors. It's tensors that have a built-in notion of locality. And here, I mean, he's not using parameterization by copying constant. He's using locality all the time. So if you know what locality is, then but if you give me a random tensor, I mean, what is the
location? Is of how easy is it to reconstruct these notions like temperature, other coupling constants,
I'm saying there is not even locality if you don't put it in. So for instance, this method works when acting on partition functions of local Hamiltonians. It doesn't have to work in general. All the replacements that I was doing locally, they may fail. They may not be, you know, the error between the norm of the difference between what I had and what I put in locally may shoot up, may not be small.
The initial tensor on your partition function, you assume some kind of locality by writing it on the tensor network.
Right, but I can take non-local stuff and write it also as a tensor network. So this is well understood. This is related to this other tensor network called PEPS for two-dimensional systems. PEPS, projected entanglement pair state. So there is this proposal, which is very successful when dealing with ground states of local Hamiltonians. So this is a two-dimensional wave function. But that wave function, in it, you can encode many things that are ground states of local Hamiltonians. And when you do that, there is no way to deal efficiently with that tensor network. Okay? You can specify the state efficiently, but you cannot extract information from it. So the same story happens here. If you don't start from a local Hamiltonian or a sufficiently local object, if you use the tensor network to represent something that is not sufficiently local, then this coarse-grained procedure will fail, will get stuck, will give you the procedure. There is an approximation activity step. Right? And we're very happy to see that this approximation can be systematically reduced by increasing the bond dimension, blah, blah, blah. And it's very small. The error is very small. This is a statement about what happens when you apply this procedure to the partition function of a local Hamiltonian. And only there.
More questions? If not, then let's thank you for again.
Thank you.